Thanks. It's a tough act to follow, but I guess it gives me the liberty not to show you all that much experimental data. So most of the work that I'll tell you about, I'm going to try and give you sort of a review of various different kinds of interaction effects and what we understand without going into too much technical detail. Most of the work that I'll tell you about was done in collaboration with Charlie Kane and Matthew Fisher, who are both here. Can correct me if I say anything wrong. I guess the advantage of giving a talk after such a beautiful one is I don't really have to waste any time with the usual hype that I would put into a talk like this. There's a lot of good hype you can do. Instead, I want to start by just very quickly reviewing the sort of non-interacting physics of these things, which is you certainly need to understand as a starting point. Then I want to introduce Coulomb interactions. And it turns out that there's a kind of nice separation in these systems between different interaction channels that really comes about because you have a separation of scales that is a reasonably large ratio between the diameter of a nanotube and the carbon-carbon bond spacing. What that allows you to do is to make a first attack at the problem just considering the strongest scattering channel, and that's forward scattering. So the next thing I'll do is introduce a forward scattering model, which actually we can essentially solve exactly. And that's a model which exhibits this nice Luttinger liquid kind of physics that you've heard about a little bit today already for edge states. But that isn't all the interactions. There are other interactions in these systems. And those actually lead to instabilities, we believe, of the forward scattering model. And I'll say a little bit about what those instabilities are. That's probably been where actually most of the theoretical work in these systems has been, although it may not be the most relevant. And then I'll finish up with telling you what we understand about mesoscopics in these nanotubes, which isn't much. You already saw a little bit of what goes on with the band structure. You can understand it with a really simple model. You just take a single honeycomb lattice of graphite and put a tight binding model, just electrons hopping from one site to another of this honeycomb lattice. It's a rather simple, fun problem to solve. You can give it to a class, graduate students at least, to solve it. A honeycomb lattice is not a Bravais lattice. There are two sites per unit cell. So in that tight binding model, you'll get two bands. And the remarkable thing that you see if you solve it is that these two bands actually touch only at two points, two distinct points in the Brillouin zone, the red point and the green point, as I've indicated here. And they touch, in fact, at zero energy. So you have a sort of degenerate Fermi surfaces. You have Fermi points rather than Fermi surfaces. And they're just these two points. Around them, the energy actually disperses linearly. That's why, for that reason, we tend to call these Dirac points. If you now want to look at a nanotube, the crudest approximation you can think of is just wrapping this thing up into a cylinder. And you can wrap it up in various different ways, parameterized by this winding vector W, or alternatively, two integers, N1 and N2, giving it in some basis of lattice vectors. And as Cass already told you, if you wrap it in some ways, the most well-known one is the armchair, then the quantization vectors, the allowed wave vectors, actually include these Dirac points. A simplest example of that is the armchair tube, where you're just quantizing along lines like this. In that case, the one-dimensional subbands include two of them which cross zero energy. So you have a sort of two-band metal with some Fermi velocity, Bf. You'd expect those to be metallic. That turns out to happen at this level for a third of the nanotubes. For the other two-thirds, these lines, the quantization momenta don't pass through these Dirac points at all. And if you look at the 1D subbands, none of them cross the Fermi energy. And you have a semiconductor. Okay. So for the rest of this talk, I'm going to essentially focus on the metallic tubes, the ones that we'd expect to be metallic from band structure. What about interactions? Remember, let me just flash this for a second. Only two out of a large number of these one-dimensional bands actually cross the Fermi surface, Fermi energy. And in particular, let's think, for instance, about the armchair tube. These are actually the bands with momentum ky, let's say the momentum around the cylinder, equal to zero. So those correspond to electronic states that are actually delocalized around the circumference of the cylinder. So if you want to think about the interaction between two electrons in those states, you can think of them essentially as ring charges around the cylinder. So if you look at two electrons that are far away in such states, they, of course, look like point charges, and they'll interact with the Coulomb interaction, one of our interaction. But if you bring them close, bring them to distances closer than the diameter of the tube, you can see the effect of this spreading out, and actually the interaction will saturate something of order 1 over the diameter of the tube rather than the separation. Well, you can carry out this more carefully in terms of projecting now this interaction down to interactions between electrons in these two bands. You have different interaction channels. One of the more important ones for transport are Umklapp processes, where you take two right-moving electrons and scatter them into two left-moving electrons. That obviously involves a large momentum exchange of order of inverse lattice spacing. Well, that probes really the short-distance properties of this potential. In fact, gives rise to a dimensionless interaction, which would be of order E squared over the Fermi velocity times the ratio of the carbon-carbon spacing to the diameter. Okay. For an NN tube, NN armchair tube, that's really a small number. It's a number of order a tenth. The same thing is true for backscattering interactions, where you take a right and a left mover and scatter them into a left and a right mover. They also get this factor of 1 over N. However, if you take, let's say, a right-moving and a left-moving electron, and you scatter them with small momentum scattering, that's probing the long-distance properties of this potential, and it doesn't get this reduction factor of 1 over N. It just senses the bare Coulomb interaction. So what we expect in a tube with N of order, say, 10, is that these forward scattering interactions are much larger. In fact, they're quite large. This number, E squared over VF, is not a small number. It's a number of order 1. So the forward scattering interactions really are strong, and it's not obvious how you should be able to treat this thing as a non-interacting system. But we know a good starting point. We can start by just looking at these forward scattering interactions. Those turn out to be rather simple. So let me describe how that goes. You can actually include them using this technology of bosonization. Many of you probably know it, and if you don't know it, I can't teach it to you in this amount of time. The idea basically is you can, in 1D, you can, there's a mathematical transformation that lets you write a fermion operator as exponential of some boson operators. And it's just a different representation of this two-band model. Instead of four fermionic modes, you can describe the same spectrum as four collective modes, one of which carries the charge of the system, and three of which are sort of relative linear combinations that carry the spin and certain other quantum numbers. Without the interactions, the Hamiltonian of these modes is very simple. It's just a quadratic Hamiltonian in these bosonic fields, theta and phi, with some Fermi velocity showing up there. When we include forward scattering, that, as I said, comes from the long-distance properties of the potential, so it's really an interaction of the total charge. For that reason, it only couples to this total charge mode. That's sort of the equivalent of the one-dimensional plasmon mode. And that total charge at long distances just looks like the gradient of this field theta. It turns out to be pretty simple to include, because in this bosonized representation, it's actually quadratic interaction. The three other modes, the three neutral modes, are just untouched by that interaction. But the plasmon mode is strongly renormalized. Its velocity is increased. That plasmon becomes stiffer with repulsive interactions. And also, a more subtle thing happens. There's another dimensionless parameter. It's called the Luttinger parameter in the system, and it gets changed. It's equal to 1 in a Fermi liquid, and actually, we'd expect it to be much smaller than 1. Some rough estimates would give a value between 0.2 and 0.3 for the 1010 tube. But you should probably take this estimate with a grain of salt. Well, this is obviously a pretty simple Hamiltonian. You can compute a lot of things with it. The most famous signature of a Luttinger liquid is in its tunneling density states. If you try and tunnel an electron into a Luttinger liquid, unlike a Fermi liquid, where this thing goes to a constant, the tunneling density of states in a Luttinger liquid is suppressed with some power law dependence, power law alpha. It actually depends, it turns out, whether you're tunneling into the bulk of a Luttinger liquid or near the end, near the tip of a nanotube. This exponent is actually bigger. Another prediction is if you look at add a small number of impurities to the system, you can get an impurity resistance which is not temperature independent as it would be in a Fermi liquid, but would be temperature dependent. So I want to take a few moments now actually to show you some very recent experiments done by the McEwen group at Berkeley, which seem to show some of this behavior, which is I find kind of exciting. This is really recent data. And then these are actually, they're a little complicated, not quite as elegant as some of the experiments you've just been seeing. They're experiments on ropes rather than individual nanotubes, laid over some electrodes, and we're just measuring two-terminal resistance, and you can modulate the number of electrons with a gate. At low temperatures, you see Coulomb blockade phenomena, and what these guys have done is to look just for samples in which they see a single periodicity here, indicating that all the tunneling is going on through a single, some sort of single quantum dot. We'd like to think, for various reasons, that single quantum dot is really a single nanotube on the rope. Well, they actually have two kinds of samples, one in which the rope is laid on top of two electrodes, and another in which the rope is laid down first and then the electrodes are put on top. And the behavior turns out to be somewhat different. If you look at the conductance as a function of temperature, in either case, you see some non-trivial power law behavior, but the power laws come out rather different in the two types of samples. Also, it's not shown here, but you can look at the conductance, differential conductance as a function of voltage, and you see the same power law behavior when the voltage is bigger than the temperature. The interpretation is just that when you lay the electrodes on top of the ropes, they're actually destroying some of the nanotubes underneath, and one's contacting instead the end of this short segment, whereas here one's contacting to the bulk of a long segment. And that's actually corroborated by measurement of the charging energy from which you can... So the black lines are actually the raw data. At low temperatures, the simple picture that you would have for an infinite nanotube is complicated by the charging effects. So the red lines are corrected with a very simple model for the charging effects. At high temperatures, that correction is small, but at low temperatures, it's important. Actually, the theory predicts not only the temperature dependence, but just as in these edge state measurements, it predicts actually a full scaling function as a function of temperature and voltage, including the same funny 2-pi factor that Charlie showed this morning. And one can collapse the conductance data as a function of voltage and temperature, It collapses rather well in these, what we are interpreting as bulk contacted measurements, and somewhat less well in the end contacted measurements for reasons that we don't really understand too well, but there are various ideas.
Different
data? Yeah. So alpha varies somewhat from tube to tube. The one trend I show you so up here were the alphas for the different types of samples. Alpha of around 0.3, 0.35 for the bulk contacted tubes, and for these end contacted tubes somewhat bigger.
You collapse different data with different alphas?
Oh, this is a single sample, what you're seeing here. Yeah, you have to determine the alpha for a particular sample. And then this is just different curves at different temperatures and voltages. That's what the different data sets are. Okay, well, we think this is encouraging.
What does that give for G, the length of
parameter? Right. These data are consistent with a Luttinger parameter of around 0.3. Yeah, if you take, let's say, the average of all the various samples to get alpha for the bulk and the end, that's consistent with the same Luttinger parameter of around 0.3.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's in the scaling function. When you're at... at large volt. Well, there's something going on here in these end contacted samples, which we don't understand. It's not... In fact, it's not obviously ohmic up there. How much time do I have?
10 more minutes.
10 more minutes?
Five minutes for this.
Okay. Let me see if I want to say anything more about that. All right. Okay, I'll stop. You can ask me more about that as we go on. I wanted to say a few more words about other things. So this is all physics that we've interpreted, at least within the context of this forward scattering model. But actually, the most theoretical work on these things has been trying to understand the effects of backscattering and Umkopf interactions. It turns out that even though these are numerically smaller than the forward scattering interactions, we expect them to be very important. In undoped tubes, more important than the backscattering are Umkopf interactions. Also, which I didn't mention, scattering against particular phonon modes of the nanotube. These are actually, even though they're weak, they're strongly relevant perturbations. And various theoretical groups have predicted, actually, that they lead to an instability of this Luttinger liquid metallic state. At zero temperature, we expect them to lead, actually, to a mod-insulating state with no spin order, sort of mod-insulating spin liquid. For the undoped tubes, we expect charge and spin gaps of comparable magnitude that actually, again, they have to be small since these interactions are small, but only power law small in the parameter N, this index of the nanotube. Roughly speaking, the physics of this is that of dimerization. Electrons are essentially, qualitatively, they're pairing up along bonds of this honeycomb lattice. At least the state is adiabatically connected to a state, a singlet state like this. And it's actually a very close mathematical relation between these systems and two-leg ladders, which also are mod-insulating spin liquids at zero temperature. Something similar happens in doped nanotubes in which Umkopf scattering isn't allowed. But backscattering is still around, and actually backscattering leads also to an instability. At zero temperature, we expect a state with a spin gap, but no charge gap. This is what's called a Luther-Emery liquid. It has a gapless charge mode and a much smaller spin gap, in fact, one which would depend exponentially on this parameter N. What kind of thing could you look at to see signatures of these instabilities? So that means 5. Okay. These are gapped states, at least single particle gaps. The forward scattering model predicts this sort of power law decrease of the tunneling density of states. At low enough energies, we'd expect actually the formation of a true gap, and this thing should pick up with some sort of Van Hove singularity above that gap edge. One caveat I have to mention is that really it's quite easy for this spin gap, particularly in the doped system, to be very small. And I don't think we really have reliable estimates for it. They're very sensitive to parts of the physics that haven't been treated too carefully. There's actually another reason, another physical mechanism that can lead to insulating behavior, and that's the effect of curvature of the tube. So far, we've only included the fact that the thing is a cylinder by just quantizing the wave vectors around there. But there are other effects. Of course, when you bend the graphite sheet, you actually bend the bonds. You'll change some of the overlap between these electrons. And what you can show, a simple calculation within this kind of tight binding model would just be to change this bond strength T perp relative to T. That'll make these Dirac points shift. And actually, for most of the what were metallic tubes, it'll pull them right off the quantized allowed values of the momentum. And they'll actually no longer be metallic. A special case is the armchair, where this shift actually doesn't destroy the metallicity. Okay, I've probably got about 3 minutes, so I'll just finish up by mentioning what we understand about mesoscopics, which, as I said, is probably not too much. So let's imagine we think about a finite nanotube, something with length L. Well, this is a finite system. It's going to have discrete level structure. In a finite system, there are a lot of different energy scales that are introduced by this length L. The one we've heard the most about so far is the charging energy of this tube, just essentially the capacitive energy to add an electron. In a one-dimensional cylinder like this, this thing essentially is an energy scale like E squared over L. However, there are also... So strictly speaking, in a cylinder like this, there's a logarithmic divergence of this energy. So you need to introduce some screening length. This is some external screening length. But there are also other level spacing energies. And in this Luttinger liquid model, this forward scattering model, there are actually two level spacings rather than a single particle level spacing. There's a level spacing associated with this plasmon mode, which is determined by this plasmon velocity. And then there's a sort of single particle level spacing determined by the original Fermi velocity, which is smaller, reduced by this dimensionless parameter g. Of course, there are also, in principle, these correlation and curvature gaps. I want to just assume that everything, that those are so small that we are always looking at physics above those energy scales. Even so, there's interesting physics just within this forward scattering model. In particular, because you have a kind of hierarchy of these energy scales, the charging energy is the largest. It's comparable to this plasmon level spacing, but that's much bigger than the single particle level spacing. In a tunneling measurement, or a finite bias conductance measurement, you can see peaks determined by all the addition energies of these electrons to the tube, and they actually come in families where you have excited different number of single particle quanta and a fixed number of plasmon quanta. Case showed you already a simple, some various pictures for Coulomb blockade. You can imagine we have a, think of the nanotube as a metallic dot. You have electrons hopping on and hopping off with some weak coupling T. You pick up extra channels of conduction every time a level gets between the potential on the left lead and the potential on the right lead. What that leads to is peaks in DIDV when an energy level crosses this energy. And actually, within this forward scattering model, what you expect is something, just look at the bottom here, is a picture like this. Just the usual, actually, sort of triangular or diamond-shaped patches in this intensity plot of DIDV versus gate voltage and bias voltage. But there are these families of peaks that I mentioned. Here we've chosen G to be, I think, 0.2, so that there are essentially five peaks in each family. You get five peaks, and then there's an increase in intensity as a second family of peaks come in. And actually, this clustering of peaks is really a signature of spin charge separation, the fact that you have separate level spacing, separate velocities for charge and spin modes. You've already seen this data. It looked more beautiful in blue and pink, and it was sideways. Now it looks familiar. As you can see, I'll keep it like that. It really doesn't look a heck of a lot like that simple picture. If I look at it with a mother's eye, I might see something that looked vaguely like families here, sort of four peaks, and then there's some other structure. But obviously, the mesoscopic, our understanding of the mesoscopics has a ways to go. So I'll just finish by putting the summary up. I think nanotubes really are a very exciting and interesting place to study 1D physics. They have a lot of advantages, not the least of which is that the energy scales we're working with are really big. You can, unlike a lot of other quasi-1D systems, you can really have isolated 1D wires. Theoretically, it is a big help that we have this separation of scales, a ratio of diameter to bond length. Gives us some hope of being able to do some controlled estimates. And they seem to be rather clean, as you saw in the previous talk. There are a lot of open questions and issues that I didn't touch on in the experiments on ropes. There's really a lot of things we don't understand in terms of the role of intertube interactions and intertube tunneling. Mesoscopics is the most open. Clearly, we need to incorporate physics beyond this forward scattering model to understand a lot of the effects you saw in the previous talk. I essentially haven't spoke about the role of defects or disorder. And down the road, of course, probably the most exciting thing would be to see how well we can build devices out of these things. So. So the question was, what's the origin of the gap that would be opened at low energies? Let's say in the undoped armchair tube. So the zero temperature gap state is actually not a state of any broken symmetry. It's a sort of dimerized state, but the system can dimerize really without breaking any symmetries because you've already broken the rotational symmetry of the lattice by wrapping it up in one particular direction. So the most analogous state you can think of is like a Haldane gap state for a spin chain. It's not a spin density wave instability or a charge density wave instability.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure I want to say too much about that.
It's quite severe.
It's quite severe in the end. It's, yeah. Okay, so, of course, the first thing I should say is when you do this end contacting measurement, you're really doing a lot. As you've shown us, you can break up a nanotube by applying a voltage to it. Here you're doing considerably more damage, presumably, by laying these contacts on there. It certainly seems to restrict the size of the intervening tube, but the extent to which the damage done to the system is changing things, that we don't know. One possible interpretation for this, I don't want to push it really, is that as we're going to higher and higher voltages, there can be a crossover between a situation in which we view this thing as end contacted and a situation where we view it as bulk contacted. So somewhere in this in this electrode, there's a contact to the nanotube. I don't know where it is on that tube. And as you increase the voltage, there's an associated length scale. And as that, so a distance between that contact and where the actual end of the tube is. It could be that disorder plays a role. It could be that there's, contacting. In this geometry, you'd be more likely to contact multiple tubes. Here, it's presumably some tube which is actually sitting on the surface at the bottom of the rope, which is being contacted. I think this geometry just needs more investigation. The temperature dependence of Umpquat, yeah, let's see, did I not put that on here? Yeah, I didn't show you that. Okay, that turns out to depend on this dimensionless parameter G. If G is close to 1 in an undoped tube, one actually expects a linear temperature dependence. And linear temperature dependence was seen sometime back in experiments on ropes. Actually, that temperature dependence changes, becomes a smaller power law as you decrease G from 1. So it's a continuously variable temperature dependence, in fact, for a Luenger liquid. Well, it's different. It's certainly in an infinite carbon sheet, you would actually need to break some symmetry to do that. Here one doesn't. I'll just show you this picture. I mean, here I've drawn some dimerized bonds, but if this had been an infinite lattice, you might just as well have asked me, why did I dimerize this and not this? But on the nanotube, actually, I've selected out an axis. I'm hiding from you technical details in some sense. The energy scales are very, very different from what you... It's certainly... The state here is certainly not well described by just a simple direct product of dimers on this... on this honeycomb lattice, it's very far from that, but it is it's adiabatically connected to that state. The way in which we understand it actually is within this two-band model. Okay, it turns out that two-band model is mathematically identical to a two-band model that you would have for a two-leg ladder. And there's actually a correspondence between this state and a dimerized state of that two-leg ladder. I'm not sure if that is any exactly what question you're asking, but
okay. So the session will stop at 4:30, and I will remind the speakers that we are supposed to be the same place as more December.